voor die bier gaan wanneer om wat kwaad voor de paap is. Pipa, papa, hier ik op haar heep, en ik hee. Koro, koro, ik heb er minna, 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 minna. Pipa, de paar, piri, piri, bebe. Greetings and welcome. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson coming at you from Darwin in the Northern Territory of Australia. Saturday, the 5th of September. It's a beautiful, nice, warm, sunny day. It's about midday. That was my native tongue from the planet Thalion, where I was telling you that what you're listening to in the background is a bit of sort of science fiction soundtrack, music stroke noise, sound collage that I've made in honor of the topic of this show, which is On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 335. It's called Operation Frankenseed, Interplanetary Rape and Exotoxicity. But before I launch into that, I'd like to honor the beautiful top end of Australia, where a lot of really powerful things have happened to me over the years, like my friend Peter Chumley and his great support for my art. My mom and dad got killed in a car wreck when I was here in 2004, and they were in America. I continued down through Western Australia. Then in 3 years later, in 2007, I met Lisbeth Verstraeten, who on that very night became my beautiful partner of 5 years. And this is the first time I've been back here in 3 years, but it's really, really wonderful. And I'd really like to thank my friend Stephen for the very, very huge, generous gift of an entire house to myself while he's in Queensland, where he actually lives. And it's just so wonderful to have the space to myself where I don't have to talk to other people if I don't want to. Like yesterday, I went an entire day, didn't talk to anybody, I didn't go anywhere. Didn't go to the beach, didn't go to the store. I did talk to my creatures just a little bit, and maybe some of the birds and the chooks. Just a few little sentences here and there. I didn't have any actual fully blown interactions with human beings other than myself, which was quite a relief in a way, sad to say. But it enables me to stay kind of in a very highly harmonious, coherent, creative space or zone. I've had this before, like when I was house-sitting in Halls Gap, Victoria. I had almost 4 consecutive uninterrupted months of quite similar to where I am now, only in a much smaller town and on the very edge of the town. So I really didn't even, I could go day after day after day, and I never even heard a car, much less have to deal with people or anything unless I went to the shop. So this is slightly more urban. I've got neighbors out back that are on Saturday. They're over there cranking up all their machinery and laughing and carrying on. And, you know, it's just kind of like, it seems like a lot of people just, when they're around other people, the main thing they have to do is talk. It doesn't matter if it's about anything or not. And I've also become very sort of wary of going to the beach. Not because of the box jellyfish who might start appearing over the next few weeks and the crocodiles that are always there, but because of the people with their dogs. That's a far greater danger to just peace and well-being, and also physically. The number of people on the beach with dogs that are just letting them run loose, unrestrained, they're not under their control by even the remotest stretch of anything. But anyway, I'm really glad to be here, and it's really, really lovely. I'm getting a lot done. But before I talk about Operation Frankenseed, I'd like to honor these beautiful little beings that are coming out in large numbers just this past week. They're, in America, we call them dragonflies. I don't know. I'm trying to learn some of the Aboriginal names for them here, but in French, they're called libellules. But they are so cool. But there is just, you know, maybe I'll look up and see two or three dozen kind of swarming around. And yesterday I was out in the backyard sort of late in the afternoon burning my sage and doing my qigong, and I turned around and there was one hovering, oh, less than a meter from me, just like right over me. And he was alone, and he was looking right at me. So I said hello to him. So I'm working on a round painting that's got four dragonflies with the sun. But they're, as I understand it, in some Native American mythologies, they're believed to be spiritual messengers. And so maybe the spiritual message that they're helping me with is, in fact, to talk about Operation Frankenseed. And now this is huge. The whole basic perspective is the existence of life on Earth, but Earth as a planet, as one of several planets in the solar system, which of course it is, but our perspective doesn't really revolve around that kind of acentrality. We still, even though we teach our kids that the Earth revolves around the sun, we still act as if the universe is anthropocentric and terracentric, which for all practical purposes in terms of day-to-day life it doesn't really matter. But anyway, a big part of my whole awareness and my work, my information activism and my work as a human RNA messenger molecule, is to try to constantly expand and increase the resolution of the big picture awareness of who and what we are and where we are and what we're doing, and trying to understand if what we're doing is the right thing that we should be doing. And I think it's pretty clear that it's not. But how can we re-navigate our process away from the clearly destructive paths that we've been deeply entrenched in for thousands of years under the paradigm of what we call civilization? I love the work of naturalist Loren Isley, who wrote quite a few books with many, many, many extremely literate, incisively perceptive essays about his different experiences of the natural world across all the different kingdoms of life, all the different niches and habitats, and even looking at the stars and the whales and dolphins and everything. And I'd like to read all of his stuff, but his very favorite thing that I've read that I keep referring to, it's two chapters from a book called The Invisible Pyramid, and it's called The World Eaters and the Spore Bearers. And he likens humanity, he says, of all his decades of study in nature, that the cellular slime molds, the myxomycophyta, are the closest thing to what humanity seems to resemble in terms of how we're functioning on this planet. And the cellular slime mold is this kind of a gooey mass that spreads out over the forest floor, and it digests and decomposes and consumes all this rotting vegetable matter and stuff. And then in a certain radius, after it's sort of depleted all the resources in a certain area, then all these sort of separated bodies of slime somehow find their way back together. They come and join back together, and they form this one mass. And then it kind of grows upward, and it sends out these stalks, and this is called its fruiting body phase. It sends out these stalks, and there's a capsule on the end filled with spores, and then at the right time the spore capsule explodes, and it sends billions of spores like everywhere to start the process over again somewhere when it finds fertile ground and the conditions are right. So he said that humanity going into space is exactly that. And he also comments on how what we've done has been the ascent of an energy ladder whose curve would be practically vertical in terms of the energy that we've released and are consuming on Mother Earth in order to accomplish our world-eating capabilities. But, you know, he's talking about our compulsion to spread, and we can look at the history of exploration. You know, like, I don't think the whole paradigm of exploration is kind of like a Western civilized kind of thing. It's not a, I think indigenous people as a whole were happy to be where they were, because they were at their home and they loved it and took care of it, and they didn't want to go to somebody else's land, and they wanted to stay home and travel their own song lines to go visit their own sacred sites and their sacred water holes and see their neighbors and stuff like that. They didn't have this compulsion to go and sail across the ocean or, you know, traverse across mountain ranges to go and find other people. You know, occasionally one, they might have kind of like, you know, grabbed a woman to be someone's wife from a neighboring tribe or something like that, but it wasn't the dominant paradigm of behavior. And so we can talk about, and then even in the modern world of travel and exploration, of course, exploration often was really just a euphemism for imperial invasion. And that's really what it turned into. Look at the history of the Spanish in South America, the history of the British in Australia and in North America and all this stuff. And then you can also look at the biology of invasion. There's an author that Rachel Carson talks about in one of her books, and it's about invasion, you know, like how insects kind of do that kind of thing, like maybe ants or wasps or termites, they might kind of come in and take over an area, but they don't take over other species too much. Anyway, another thing we can talk about is the kind of what I call the open membranes of biospheres, the whole hypothesis of panspermia that I talked about with Fred Watson a few weeks ago. To me, panspermia wasn't just about the origin of diseases here, having come from space, but the possibility that life itself came to Earth from somewhere else a long time ago. But it's something we'll probably never know. But it's very interesting to think about this kind of thing. A lot of people have written and researched the origin of life on Earth from comets and asteroids, and also Evgeny Markinin, the Russian scientist, his research with the origin of life in volcanoes, which is very interesting. And then Thomas Gold's idea of the deep hot biosphere, where he's saying that the majority of the biomass of life is not on the surface, it's not in the air, it's not in the ocean, it's not mammals, it's not insects, it's not birds, it's microscopic microbes that are tiny little organisms. Many of them are anaerobic or maybe extremophiles and thermophiles. They don't need sunlight, they don't need oxygen, they don't need water. They don't even photosynthesize. They exist off of chemical processes. But they're life forms that can live deep down in the Earth's crust and even down into the mantle. And so he hypothesized that organisms like this would be easily able to survive and live for a long time on, for example, the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, maybe Jupiter and Saturn themselves, maybe on Mars. And then when you look at how many bodies in the solar system have water, possibly even liquid water in some places, like maybe Uranus and Neptune or some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and then water in ice formations, that would be all kinds of possibilities for life. And then we must remember that in that brilliant science fiction book and movie, The Andromeda Strain, they were researching it, and it had no nucleic acids, it had no amino acids, and so it was actually, it was a crystal. So that's very, very interesting. And when you talk about how Rupert Sheldrake talks about how that when chemists are trying to synthesize they're trying to crystallize out a brand new substance that's never been made before, sometimes it's extremely hard to do. They just can't get it to happen. But once it happens, once somewhere, then many other places happen very, very easily all of a sudden. Sort of like a holomorphogenetic resonance field for this new crystal. So if we think about that kind of interconnectedness of everything and the origins of life and the origins of, I don't even really want to talk about diseases because there's so much fiction and disinformation about that whole kind of thing. I mean, it's almost like it's a fictitious paradigm in itself, the whole notion of disease. I'm not saying that, I mean, the whole idea of germ theory, well, I don't know, but that's not what this show is about, but it's related. But we're talking about two different things here. We're talking about not even the accidental contamination of other bodies in the solar system, specifically Mars, but we're also talking about the deliberate contamination of it, and not with traditional biological life forms, but with genetically engineered life forms. And so where did my awareness of all this start? Well, I'm going to name some names. About 4 years ago, I was in the Warren Bungles visiting some astronomers. Malcolm Hartley invited me to come and stay with him and his wife Laura from Scotland. Really, really cool people. And he had discovered some comets, and he was at the Siding Spring Observatory. And I got in touch with him because of my interest in comets had really been piqued by my experience with the dolphins back in 2015, and then Fred Watson told me about Victor Klub and Bill Napier. When I was visiting Malcolm Hartley, he gave me a book to read by a guy that he used to work there named Duncan Steele. Duncan Steele's book was all about the idea of the Earth being bombarded or impacted by comets and asteroids, and how this had happened a lot over the existence of the Earth, and also could happen again. So it was very, very interesting, and I read a lot of the book and tried to get in touch with him to see if he would do an interview, but he was quite recalcitrant, and they told me he was kind of an eccentric person that had some issues and stuff like that. And so he emailed me a couple of articles, which was cool, but wouldn't really communicate. He wouldn't do an interview with me on Skype. So anyway, I found myself house-sitting in Nelson, New Zealand back in December of last year. And I knew that's where he was living. And so through a woman that lives in the town there, I actually got a message to him and told him I was there in town and asked if he'd wanted to catch up for a coffee and maybe do an interview, and so we did. And I had always thought of him as the comet and asteroid authority. And that's what I had hoped to talk about. So that's what we did our interview about. But then he told me that was pretty much a thing of his past. He was still doing some work, and I really wanted to thank him for putting me in touch with Bill Napier and Victor Klub, the two legendary comet researchers that Fred Watson had told me about, and because of that, I was able to send them painted rocks and get in touch with both of them. But he said that work was a thing of his past, and that the company he's working for now, which is called Xerra, X-E-R-R-A, it's kind of I don't know, it seems kind of shadowy to me. It's kind of a nebulous company that supposedly they're involved in processing and interpreting data from satellites. But when you think about that covers a lot of ground, and you think of who wants and uses that kind of information, and it's largely military and industrial stuff. And a lot of it's like classified. So I started wanting to know more about that. But then that's when they kind of shut me out. They didn't want to talk about what they're doing now. But the point that I'm getting to is that when I first looked at Duncan Steele's website, about 4 years ago, I happened to notice that one of the books that he said he's writing now is a book about disseminating genetically modified organisms on Mars. And I'm like, what? Nah, it's got to be a joke, because he made some funny statements in other parts of his website. So I thought this was just a joke that he was making. And so when I interviewed him in person, I asked him, and he goes like, oh no, I'm actually writing a book about disseminating genetically modified organisms on Mars. And so I was quite astounded that he was serious about it. But, and as this was right at the end of our interview, I didn't really have a chance to go into it with him. And then they sort of got annoyed with me for asking questions about what Zira actually does. So anyway, this was a year ago. And so I've really been thinking about this a lot. And another really, really interesting synchronicity. And remember, Jung's book, his treatise, was called Synchronicity, an A-causal connecting principle. That synchronicity involves the simultaneous perception of unrelated events, related only by the fact that we perceive them at the same time in our own personal temporal reference frame. But just around the same time that this was really coming onto my radar, that I'd been thinking about the implications of deliberately contaminating Mars with genetically modified organisms, this was back in February of this year, right around that exact same time is when the whole thing started exploding in Wuhan, China, with all the coronavirus stuff. And I go like, well, you know, that's just such a weird synchronicity. But it seemed like kind of planetary karma in a way, you know, that even it was like a karmic precursor, that if humans were even thinking of doing something like disseminating genetically modified organisms on Mars, if we were even thinking about it, that's enough to just set off karmic repercussions, even though we haven't even done it yet, or hopefully haven't. And so that's kind of what I was talking about in last week's show, the karma of COVID, about how the whole idea of karma is a sort of highly intelligent cosmic justice system. And it's, you can't hide from it, you can't fool it. It's not like, you can't pull anything over the wools of the eyes of karma. It's like, because it's the interconnected repercussions of the actions themselves. There's no intermediary interpreting judgmental, you know, sort of like epiphenomenon being or something like that. It's just like, it's the result of the actions themselves in ways that we don't really understand. And maybe there is an element of randomness to it, but maybe there's levels of interconnection that happen between all kinds of different levels of reality and kingdoms that we just really don't even understand. And maybe it is intermediated by beings, but I don't know. But so what I've really started looking into is, well, you know, there's a whole thing about Mars itself. You know, Mars as one of the planets, and its long-standing position in our psyche as a place that other beings have come from, or, you know, that we want to go to. You know, and so that's a whole interesting thing in itself, is why Mars? Maybe because it's the most Earth-like planet in some ways, not in terms of size, but in terms of the habitability factor. Like, we could probably, if you could get there without being burned up and mutated, you could walk around on the surface if you were able to breathe. I think you'd be zapped by cosmic rays, but I think that the atmospheric pressure is such that you wouldn't have to have a pressurized suit, but the air is like 90% carbon dioxide, so you wouldn't have anything to breathe in the air pressure. Anyway, I don't know anything about this, but Mars has been big. That's where the beings that invaded us in War of the Worlds back in 1939, they came from Mars. And so then there's been all the stuff about the canals of Mars, which weren't really formed by water, and just, you know, countless science fiction movies about Martians and My Favorite Martian and all this stuff. Why Mars? And, you know, maybe all this does hint at ancient connection from there that maybe some people know about, or that it's kind of a deeply ingrained thing in our collective psyche, maybe even in our genetic consciousness. But whenever I started really thinking about this, I went like, well, you know, I know for a fact, this is before I even started looking into it, but I already knew that scientists from the dawn of the space age had always had a very powerful imperative or protocol that any craft going anywhere else, to the moon or other planets or moons of other planets, needed to be absolutely as sterile as possible so that we didn't accidentally contaminate another world with our own, you know, sort of microbes and stuff like that. And not that anything from here is necessarily bad, but it might have unexpected and disastrous consequences in the same way that when Spanish conquistadors came to the Americas, they brought many different diseases, including smallpox, which just decimated the populations of the Americas that didn't have any immunity to them built up. And then that was probably accidental to begin with, but then they started realizing that itself could be used as a weapon. Probably the earliest form of biological warfare was giving the smallpox-infested blankets to the Native Americans and stuff like that. So anyway, then I started reading that astronomer Carl Sagan, who's one of my biggest heroes. He was a planetary scientist, very well-known educator about all things astronomical, a very outspoken nuclear awareness educator and activist who protested over 100 times on the ground at the Nevada test site, and that's why he contracted the rare form of leukemia that he died from, according to a lot of people. But he and some other people authored some papers back in the late 50s, criticizing this space protection rule that they came up with back then that sounded good on paper, but Sagan and his other researchers said, well, this is not nearly strict enough. It needs to be a lot, there needs to be a lot less amount of stuff that can be allowed to go, spores and microbes and bacteria and all different kinds of stuff like that. So he was up against the powers that be even back then. And so all those things now, I forget exactly what it's called, the protocols for space protection and stuff, and they, if you look into it more deeply, which I've begun to do a little bit, it's kind of like under the auspices of the United Nations, and they're sort of like granting themselves this global authority that really doesn't even exist. And why other nations and organizations believe this authority is, that's a huge question in itself, because why would they possibly have dominion over the world? It just never made any sense to me. The World Health Organization, I mean, who created that and why? What gives them any authority over anybody? So anyway, in the same way that the United Nations, a branch of it sprang up 10 or 20 years ago called the International Seabed Authority. And they just sort of sprung out of nowhere, but they are selling permits for companies or countries to do deep seabed mining in areas that are international territory that don't belong to any country, and that is the body of Mother Earth. So how they can do that and get away with it, I mean, who can accept all this as being genuine, believable, bureaucratic stuff that we should owe any allegiance to or even obey? Anything having to do with the United Nations, anything global at all, it's illegitimate. It's bogus. It's like, you know, it should just be challenged and dismantled, especially anything related to health or related to deep seabed mining. But the basic idea is that mainstream science all along, for many, many reasons, believe that we should do our best to ensure that we don't accidentally contaminate the moon or Mars or any of its moons or other planets. And part of it is that if there was things that are alive there, or, you know, organisms, or, you know, other beings of some kind, it may not be life as we know, but we don't want to interfere with them, with stuff from here, before we can even discover or possibly even communicate with who might already be there. And just because we can't see it or detect it doesn't mean it's not there. That's a huge fallacy in terms of the modern scientific disposition. So I've likened, you know, if even if we go somewhere, we're automatically contaminating it, even just with ourselves, with our own presence and our own technology. And it's not that there, you know, if in the same way that a chemical can be an essential nutrient, but if it's in the wrong place at the wrong time or too much of it, it can become a deadly poison. In the same way, the presence of a life form could be perfectly harmonious or benign or even essential if it's where it belongs, like indigenous people, but when it goes where it doesn't belong, like traveling to a different continent or going down in the ocean or up into space or onto another planet, it can become a deadly toxin. And so that could be what's happening. And I liken the effect, hopefully it's not going to go this far, and I really don't think it can, but if you look at what's happened to Mount Everest in the past few decades, in the past few years, it was first ascended by Sir Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa. And his Sherpa was actually the first guy to set foot very on top of the summit. But, I mean, we don't know who might have gone up there before that. All kinds of, like, Tibetan and Nepalese Yeti gurus might have gone up there. But anyway, this was in the mid to late 1950s. But then since then, oh, I'm not sure when, maybe even beginning in the 1990s, and this sort of happened without me even being aware of it. Tourism industry sort of started granting these deals with the Nepalese government where people would pay $100,000 as a permit to be allowed to climb Mount Everest. And then they would sign on with these expeditions that would pay for all their stuff and lead them up there. And I had no idea that this had been going on that scale, but apparently hundreds or even thousands of people try to march up there every year. And when I saw a photo from National Geographic from a year or two ago, and I go, holy fuck! It was like a line of ants trying to get to the summit of Mount Everest, and some of the people were keeling over and dying. And I mean, you know, at that altitude, helicopters can't fly, and most people need help breathing. And so it just seemed absolutely one of the most insane operations I've ever seen people trying to do. All these kind of rich yuppies think they want to climb Mount Everest just so they can say they did, and a lot of them never make it back down. But the problem is that once all this shit gets up there, it has to stay. Who's going to carry down a bunch of oxygen bottles and tents and rubbish and stuff when they can just barely make it themselves, if they do? And if they can't, they end up staying there. There's the summit of Mount Everest, that area is littered with like dozens of bodies, tents, oxygen bottles, just, I mean, it's like a junkyard and a burial ground of bodies laying there, of stuff that got there, but it can't get down. And so the Everest syndrome is hopefully not what's going to happen to Mars and the moons of Jupiter, but if Elon Musk has his way, that's going to be a major both invasion and contamination. So we've got accidental contamination, which has already happened ever since we first sent our very first space probe to the moon and then to Mars and the moons of Mars and Jupiter and Saturn and stuff. Anything that didn't burn up in the atmosphere, if it landed, it would have contaminated these bodies with something. And whether whatever it was has survived or not, or is still lurking there as spores like viruses or something like that, or has mutated or has been assimilated by something else, or who knows what the possibilities are. So we've already breached that threshold. But as far as I know, that's all been sort of like side effects of us going there and sending probes. But to me, the idea of deliberately, and I'll use the word infecting, because Duncan Steele, in an article, used that word. He goes like, he talks about infecting Mars with genetically modified organisms. So the implication in the use of that term is it's like deliberately giving the smallpox-infested blanket to the Native Americans. That's what it sounds like to me. And it's really made me think of this person as, I call him Frankensteel, Dr. Frankensteel, ever since I started thinking about all this stuff. I think it's one of the most diabolical things. This puts him up there with people like Mengele's and all the Nazi war criminals that did all the experiments in impregnating women with gorilla semen and operating on them without their knowledge. And this is in that same category of Nazi scientist experimentation. So doing it intentionally is extraordinarily evil. But now we get to the part of the fact that his idea isn't even to just put life forms there like microbes and bacteria and maybe plants and little amoebas and tardigrades and things, but genetically modified ones. And so now, what exactly does that mean? In talking about genetically modified organisms and genetic engineering, I'd first like to thank an American man who I met in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2002 named Charles Drace, D-R-A-C-E. And back then, he put together the world's first compendium about genetic engineering and genetically modified organisms, and specifically from the point of view of it creating a potential disaster for New Zealand in terms of the importance of agriculture there and what it really was. So I've got a copy of this book, and I've circulated dozens of copies of it all through everybody that I knew way back then, and interviewed him, and I wish I could find that interview. I've got it on a hard drive somewhere, but anyway, I need to get in touch with him. But he's primarily an economist or an investment broker, so he was interested in the economic impacts of genetic engineering. But this was in 2002. So then in 2009, I think it was, the work of a researcher named William Engdahl, E-N-G-D-H-A-H-L, came to my attention in his book called The Seeds of Destruction, all about the history of genetic engineering and what it actually is. I think this is what really first put him on my radar, but I got in touch with him, and we've been in touch ever since. And he's written many books about the history of oil and U.S. Anglo American hegemony and full spectrum dominance and the gods of money. But there's common elements in all of this stuff. The wealthy international banking cartel families, for example. But to me, his book, Seeds of Destruction, is his most important book for two reasons. One is that it gives in-depth scientific information about what genetic engineering actually is and how dangerous it is. But he also names names about the strategy and who supported it from the beginning and what it's been used for. And also there's a chapter in there called The Brotherhood of Death, where he names names about people that have been in the employ of these banking families and the military and stuff. And a lot of them are these doctors of death, of which I think Duncan Steele should actually be included in this now. So anyway, in William Engdahl's book, Seeds of Destruction, he really goes into great detail about what genetic engineering actually is. And then also there's a guy named Jeffrey Smith, who is a very top researcher about the reality of genetic engineering. And so I just emailed Jeffrey Smith and William Engdahl yesterday asking them if they could each write a few sentences for me sharing their opinion on Operation Frankenseed. And so hopefully I'll be able to share that. In essence, genetic engineering is not even remotely similar to breeding of animals. That's like using that's with animals where the pollen can crossbreed, or the semen from the animal can impregnate a female of another species or another subspecies. But that's completely different. What we're talking about is actually changing the genetic structure of life forms, manipulating the strands of DNA and the chromosomes and the nucleic acids and all this kind of stuff. And one of them is called recombinant technology. And I'm not really up on all the technical stuff, but it's all revolves around extremely sophisticated computer systems now. And there's a thing called CRISPR, C-R-S-P-R, that has to do with gene sequencing and editing and stuff. But one of the biggest things is that these scientists have tried to create new forms of life that could never exist in nature, or by creating weird hybrids or grafting, say for example, creating a goat that could make spider silk, or that kind of thing. I mean, if I took the time and started looking into what we actually know about what genetic engineering has been doing for a long time, it would probably seem very, very horrific. But we do know that the main thing with the main idea that they said that it was for was to feed the world, to try to grow more food for people. But the actual purpose has been that of depopulation. That's what William Engdahl says in his book, The Seeds of Destruction, that's what it was conceived as, a way of controlling the world's food supply. And it's not so necessarily by starving people, but by creating frankenfoods that contain all kinds of dangerous things that might either kill people outright or do stuff like make them infertile, or damage them in different kind of ways over and genetically over long periods of time. And so this is the kind of thing that you can't just create a genetically modified life form and then instantly know how it's going to behave. I mean, because all different things have different time frames, that you need to study them over many different generations. Like, for example, fruit flies reproduce very rapidly. So that's why Mueller was able to understand what the mutagenic effects of X-rays over a relatively short amount of time. But Arnold Layman, the genetic toxicologist who was a colleague of Rachel Carson back in the 1960s, he said that if we really want to understand what mutagenic chemicals and radiation is doing to humans, we need to study at least 25 generations of people, which is like 300 years. And like we who exist now, we're only the third generation of people to exist since all these synthetic mutagens started coming into being. And when you look at GMOs as a synthetic mutagen, that's only come into being in the past 30 years, one generation ago. So this is all the kind of the backdrop against, it's universally agreed across the board, anything that's genetically engineered is extremely dangerous. That basically what we're creating is viruses. It's a virus that we've created if it's genetically modified, and that the genetically modified substances, like if you eat some GMO corn or fruit or vegetable or something like that, that genetically modified nucleic material can enter your own body through your digestive system, and that modified, mutated genetic material can become part of you. I mean, this is part of the science fiction scenario that we've known about all along. And this has only really been possible because of a lot of the work that happened with the Human Genome Project and the work with the supercomputers that can manipulate all this data and stuff. But there's a company called Monsanto that we all know about, and they were formed kind of like as a daughter product of E.G. Farben, the Nazi chemical company. And everything that they've ever created has been a weapon system, chemical, biological weapon. They created Agent Orange, the notorious defoliant that killed everybody in Vietnam and gave them cancer. They've created this stuff called glyphosate, more popularly known as Roundup, one of the most ubiquitous carcinogenic and mutagenic poisons it's like everywhere. The whole biosphere of Earth is practically saturated with that stuff now. And so they just got bought out by Bayer, another giant E.G. Farben company that specializes in pharmaceuticals, but just because they changed their name. But Monsanto, more than any other company, had more people in the Obama administration than anybody else. So what does that tell you? And just because they've morphed into something else. So when you think of anybody that wants to send genetically modified organisms to Mars, who are they working for? And what do they actually think they're going to do? And so I haven't even got to the thing of like, that to me, doing something like this, it's like raping a virgin planet to infect a basically a virgin life form place, if you think of a planet as a being, with poison semen that's not even real semen. You know, it's like it's diabolical in several different ways. It's just demented. It's nefarious and demented. And so whoever to me would think of something like this is completely a kook, in the same way that Frankenstein was. But this dude is not a random fringe kook in the sense of that he's just somebody lurking off in an isolated laboratory. No, this guy is very well connected. He has held or currently holds security clearances from the Australian government, maybe from other countries too. His work has been involved in the space and militaries of several countries, and the company he works for now, being a company that processes satellite data in New Zealand. New Zealand's basically being run since the Christchurch quake in 2011 by the world's biggest defense contractor called Lockheed Martin. And they actually build nuclear missiles. They run cybersecurity for the U.S. government. And if you look at their website, they're heavily involved in Mars. And they also bought this company called Rocket Lab that's putting rockets into space from the East Cape there on the North Island of New Zealand. So Duncan Steele would be connected with Lockheed Martin, who has the technical ability to put stuff on Mars. And there's this other researcher that's the other top scientific researcher there at Zira. I can't remember his name, but he's an American guy, a computer geek, that went to like Brown University or something like that, or Yale. He went to Yale. And he worked at Oak Ridge National Laboratory for about 10 years, where he spearheaded a program that created the highest resolution map of the surface of the Earth. And now he's working at Zira there. So if you think of who wants that kind of information, it starts smacking of this whole Internet of Things. But the interesting connection with Oak Ridge National Laboratory is that now they've got one of the largest supercomputer installations on the planet. Oak Ridge was formed back in the 1940s. It was the primary hub of the Manhattan Project, not for design, but for creation and refining of the plutonium and stuff like that. So it was a central hub of the Manhattan Project. Now they've got this giant bank of supercomputers, and it's known for its work in genetic engineering and this technology called CRISPR, C-R-S-P-R, that has to do with gene sequencing and stuff like that. So, between Oak Ridge and Lockheed, Duncan Steel would be very well connected to actually put genetically modified organisms on Mars. And I really think that this Operation Frankenseed needs to get shot down before it even has the remotest chance of happening. There's another organization called DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and they're also involved in a bunch of nefarious scientific stuff, but they're also involved. They've got articles about genetically modified organisms on Mars, and it's very casual the way that they talk about it. They're going like, oh, well, maybe we'll send some GMOs there that can convert the Martian sand into concrete. How about that? I mean, this mentality of just casually manipulating life forms to do stuff that we think is convenient for us. What if they really wanted to dump a bunch of microbes there that they thought are going to start converting the Martian atmosphere to have more oxygen so we can breathe it? Because right now it's about 95% carbon dioxide. I mean, who knows? I mean, I could start reading up on articles about what all they think they're going to do with this, and this is just what we know about. There could be ones where they're going to release GMOs that might do 3D printing of new Terminator life forms out of the silicon in the Martian soil. I mean, we're talking pure science fiction here, but these people think that they can actually do it. Then you've got Elon Musk talking about going to Mars. I mean, you know, apparently this is really big. I'm doing this show out of really incredulity and astonishment that people are taking this so seriously, and the horrific spiritual consequences. Like, you know, like I said in last week's show, if there's anything left that humanity can do that can really anger the gods, including the gods themselves as being the planets. You know, I mean, if Mother Earth is a being, which she, of course, how could she not be? Of course, Mars is, and Jupiter and Saturn and the Sun and all their moons and everybody and all the comets and asteroids. So I don't think we're going to get too much further with all this. But I also started talking about a new concept I made up called exotoxicity. It's about our exporting of contaminants to other worlds. But that also includes electromagnetic radiation. And in my blog post last week, I talked about how in the Carl Sagan novel Contact, beings on a planet around Vega, which is 25 light years away, had received the Berlin Olympic Games, which is the first powerful enough transmission from Earth to go that far. They sent it back to us, and along with it was some encoded information about how to build a device. So if you think along those lines, everything that we've been sending out, well, if that was the leading edge of our electromagnetic transmissions that can leave the solar system, then that would be a sphere of 84 light years or more going in every direction, where anybody within that sphere of that radius would know that we exist now. And then if they're closer than that, or as time goes by, everything that's much more intense and that we're sending now will gradually reach out there, like, and it's like an expanding wavefront that we might appear as a brilliant supernova at certain radio frequency wavelengths to anybody else that might be listening, or we might create waves of mutagenicity or ecotoxicity that might go through and create mutations on other worlds, or distort their weather or their climate, or cause earthquakes. I mean, this is science fiction, of course. But we have no idea of how we might be coming across to whoever else might be out there. But to deliberately infect Mars with genetically modified organisms is something that really needs to be shot down right now. One of my favorite artists and thinkers, Friedrich Hundertwasser, said that when we reach an abyss, the most intelligent thing we can do is take a step back. So that's where I think we are. We're on the brink of self-annihilation and of bringing down the most intense karmic retribution from all avenues of intelligence in the whole heliocosm and the local universe. And we're not going to save ourselves, but in honor of what Thomas Bunyakya the Hopi elder said, that we're not going to prevent the day of purification, but we can hope to lessen its severity by everything we do that's good now. So let us all try to live simply so that others may simply live, and live on the true path of the Great Spirit. Bring our own lives into the highest coherence with the best knowledge and wisdom that we have, and to stop doing most of what we're doing, and give Mother Earth a chance to heal in our own selves and bodies. Stop poisoning our minds and bodies with fear. And I think in next week's show, I'm going to talk about how the whole paradigm of like vaccines and diseases and stuff, that's so old school. It's almost like Newtonian Cartesian compared to the quantum relativistic world of placebos and evacs and belief. The power of belief. Like if somebody believes they've been vaccinated, or they believe that they've been irradiated, could serve the same purpose. But that's for next week's show. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off. Many thanks to Jules Stanley at UCY-TV and Teddy, Wally, Ruby, and Big Teddy, Heidi, Phil, Huckabart, Barris, Ninja, Freddy, Ellie, Wally, Kali, and Peter.
Wavy-ups, we wants to go and be on the TV radio show beneath Grandmother Baobab in the Botanical Garden.
And we'll go and record a show there next week.
Good night.